what percentage of enterprise data is unstructured data? Kate Sowell is Director of Technical Product Management for Granite. Kate, welcome back to the show. What's your estimate?
This feels like a trap. without, just a wild guess, I'm going to say 40%.
Shobhit Varshney is Head of Data and AI for the Americas. Shobhit, tuning in live from Vegas. What do you think?
200%. Have you seen the quality of structured data in companies?
All right, great. And last but not least, and joining us for the very first time, is Hillary Hunter, IBM Fellow and CTO of IBM Infrastructure. You've got an advantage on this question, but I don't know if you want to offer your guess.
Yeah, I'll take the midpoint there. Not exactly the midpoint, but I'll go with 80%.
Okay, great. So the answer is 90%. We're going to talk about that today. And all that and more on the very 50th episode of Mixture of Experts, 50th episode, crazy. And welcome for...
Woohoo!
Yeah, woohoo! I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a talented and just lovely group of researchers, product leaders, and more to discuss and debate the week's top headlines in artificial intelligence. As always, there's a ton to cover. We're going to talk about the Llama 4 release, Shobhit's in Vegas. He's going to tell us all about Google Cloud Next, some really super interesting research coming out of Pew Research. But today, we want to take the opportunity, because Hillary is on the line with us, to talk about IBM Z, which is a new launch that just came out on, I believe, Tuesday. And it concerns mainframes. And so I guess, Hillary, do you want to just start, for listeners who are less familiar with the sector, what is a mainframe anyways, and why is it important?
Yeah, I think first fun fact is Z stands for zero downtime. And mathematically, that's kind of an interesting conversation. We talk about the system now having 8 nines of reliability. And the way that you count those nines is you say it's 99 point and then 6 more nines. So that's how you get to 8 nines of resiliency. Yeah, but it means just a couple hundred milliseconds a year of downtime on average. And so, you know, when I talk to family members or I meet someone socially, I kind of say we work on building the computers that you don't see and that you just sort of assume are there and never think about. And what that means is really this is where most of the world's financial transaction volume, everything from things in the market to your personal credit card transactions, go through it in the back end. And you hopefully never think about whether or not that computer is going to work or your credit card transaction goes through. These are these systems that we just all assume are up all the time. And so it's really kind of at the core of the global economy, to be honest. That's really not an exaggeration.
Yeah, what I love about this is like you work on like arguably some of the highest stakes computing. And I think one of the most interesting things about the launch is that I know AI is a big part of this launch in some ways. I know there's sort of Z17, which is the mainframe, and then there's Z, sort of the software, which sounds like kind of IBM pushing into the idea that these, you know, 6 nines of reliability computers really are going to get, you know, sort of integrated into the overall sort of AI revolution, which, you know, we talked about on the show before. AI, you know, is not always kind of like production. It like sometimes, you know, messes up. It's stochastic. It has all sorts of randomness. So curious to hear a little bit more about like what's getting launched on the software side, and I guess how you kind of like get AI to work at like such a high level of reliability that I think most software developers never even need to think about as they're kind of vibe coding or whatever.
Yeah, it's a pretty different space, but it's equally fascinating, I think, to that whole vibe coding kind of space that a lot of folks are interacting with now on a daily basis. From a technical perspective, getting things done in transaction means having millisecond level AI. And that means super, super fast, tightly integrated, being able to handle billions of transactions a day, and being able to score things at line speed, right? So again, anecdotal sort of example, if you're talking about fraud and analytics in the credit card transaction processing space, if I as a consumer am buying something online, it's okay. There's minutes to hours before the thing gets shipped out, you know, so fraud can happen offline. But if it's in a store and somebody's trying to rip you off and buy an expensive phone or something like that at Best Buy, you want to make sure that instantaneously, the moment the transaction goes through, that it's detected as being fraudulent. And so there's actual real economic value and consumer value to being able to score every transaction in real time And the interesting thing that we're now talking about being possible on this next generation of mainframe is multi-model AI. So a really small, fast, compact model that's running there right on the processor, dealing with this massive transaction throughput. Maybe occasionally it has low confidence in the scoring it provided, and it needs to be backed up by a bit more robust, complicated model. And so we're putting extra AI cards called the Spire card into the system to enhance not just being able to do that super fast processing on the processor itself, but also do fast processing one step slightly removed and adjacent on a PCIe attached set of cards. And so we've just multiplied the AI capacity and throughput for the system. And also then from the perspective of then the total system experience on the software side, like you said, we announced something called Operations Unite, which is AI ops driven, AI chat driven interface to everything going on in the system. So observing, remediating issues, all happening in a totally modern interface. So it's pervasive. Once you put the AI capability in, it's not just about the workloads running in the system, but also how people use and operate and keep the whole thing stable and healthy.
Yeah, that's awesome. So Shobhit, I'd love to bring you in. I know I launched this episode with a question about just how much unstructured data enterprises are sitting on. And I'm sure this is a problem that you have to deal with and that you talk about with customers day in, day out. I know that's a component of this launch, but curious if you want to just opine a little bit on kind of how the world is evolving there and I guess how the Z launch sort of fits into some of those questions.
Big fan of the Z series, and I grew up in a cloud-first, AI-first world, and I have so much respect for understanding the right balance between where mainframe should be playing versus where the clouds are, right? So as an example, working with a very, very large bank where we're leveraging cloud environments with a lot of different GPUs and compute behind it to train the models. But once you have fine-tuned the models to enterprise data, you want to go bring it where the transactions are happening. And these are sub-milliseconds, right? Very, very quickly you're having doing this and you're doing billions and billions of these every hour. So you want to bring the AI inference as close as possible to where the transaction is happening. In the first wave of doing unstructured content analysis, you would have some large language model that summarizes a call recording or starts to do some knowledge search and things of that nature. Now in the next wave, once we've proven out that this technology is working, you want to do this in more mission-critical workflows. For example, when fraud detection happens, like Hillary was mentioning, there's a lot of patterns that we need to look for. It's not just that one transaction that happened. You also need to look for how that transaction was going through, or at that point of the transaction happening in sub-milliseconds, the larger models have a lot of latency. You can obviously not afford to have that data go out to the cloud and come back, A, security issues, and B, the latency and other things, right? So we are in the world where we see a lot of our larger Fortune 100 companies move from experimenting with large frontier models that are API calls to then fine-tuning smaller open models and bring them closer to the compute. So I think the Z series works incredibly in this space. And we also have the brand permission with Z. They're like, Hillary, 90% of all credit card transactions happen on Z, and 90% of the Fortune 50 banks rely on us and whatnot, airlines, retailers. So you're in the mission-critical workflows. This is no longer, hey, let me ask the prompt a different way. Right. So you're not experimenting. You are doing this in more critical workflows.
You know, I love that you went to latency. I think one of the things related as well to that whole leaving the system is the data security model, data sovereignty, all those other really hot topics. And so I think also bringing AI to where that data is and where that mission critical data is, where that valuable and sensitive consumer and personal information is a big part of this conversation. I think one other thing in addition, again, to latency and then that data protection is also the energy. So we've greatly increased the AI capability and the overall capability of the system, but dropped this whole system generation to generation by 17% in the power consumption. And the team has measured that it's about 5x more efficient to do that AI in place where the data is than, to your point, calling out to some external system. So these days, everybody's running out of power, looking to take out more data center space, all that other kind of stuff. And being able to do AI so efficiently, I think is a really exciting step forward.
And Hillary, just about a month back, I was with one of the largest top three credit card companies, and we were having this concern around fraud detection and said, we can obviously do a lot of LLM work to understand patterns, right? It's not just a spot in time. And even a month back, we struggled to bring models that are LLM models in real time transactions because it's just sub millisecond and stuff. And I was just so proud that in the last week, we've been able to go after those use cases that we couldn't even a few weeks back, right? So we're coming to a point where clients understand that they've proven it out inside of their enterprises, that we can use LLMs and we've trained them in a particular way. But latency was coming in the way of us doing this for a lot of our clients. So just huge kudos to your team to doing this right.
I think you bring enough AI and to your point, the creativity just explodes. Every developer in kind of this core of the enterprise space is now, oh, that's now for me. That's not something for people elsewhere in different environments. It's now insurance claims processing, even medical image assessment. There's all kinds of amazing things going on that core data because AI is also for those people and for that data and for that context also.
That's super exciting. So Hillary, before we move on to the next topic, what comes next for you all?
Yeah, so the capabilities with Spire come out in fourth quarter. There's a rolling set of announcements on the different software enhancements. And I think the way to think about it is we're making these systems AI through and through. Like I kind of mentioned, you know, starting back even in ZOS 3.1, the last release, there was AI inside things starting to look in that direction of self-healing or sort of automation of management of the efficiency of the system. What we've stated about ZOS 3.2, which is going to be coming out, is even more integration of that smartness into the core and the heart of how the system operates and then how operations teams experience it and going all the way out even into our support staffing. So if you call IBM for help with something now, we are also using WatsonX technology to help those agents who are helping you with your mainframe. So that's a project that we started within our technology lifecycle services organization with our storage products. And we've announced now this week that we're also bringing that to mainframe support. So that whole experience end to end, how the system runs, what you can do on it, what you understand about it, and then how somebody helps support you is all going to be AI enabled. And I think that end to end and full stack story is just really exciting. This is us living what we've been talking about with the power of AI.
This is awesome. Yeah. So we'd love to have you back on the show as things unfold here. I think it's a segment of AI that we haven't talked as much about, but I love it personally just because it is like this kind of very high stakes thing. You really got to get it right in these domains. And so, it's a kind of AI almost engineering that you don't really see in a whole lot of other places, which is really exciting. So I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Meta has released Llama 4, a long-awaited release in the open source space. There's three models that they've talked about, two of them actually announced, the Scout model, the Maverick model, and the Behemoth model. And it follows in a pattern that we've seen elsewhere in the open source space where people are launching both smaller models and bigger models to meet a variety of different applications. Kate, maybe I'll start with you. I don't know if you had a chance to kind of play with some of the models yet, but curious about your early impressions, your vibe check on how this release went.
Yeah, it's been a busy week, so I haven't had a chance to play with them directly, but it's really exciting to, I've been reading up on them, certainly, and it's really exciting to see what Meta put out there. With the release of their largest model, which is over 400 billion parameters, I believe, mixture of experts, and 100 billion parameters, I think, is the Scout. They're really starting to take on larger and larger tasks and create, some powerful models out in the open source ecosystem. I think with the announcement of their Behemoth model, which is, 2 trillion parameters, I think
that's
what
that's
they
big,
said.
Right? That's big.
That's pretty big, Tim. They're talking about, you've already on earlier trained versions, checkpoints, it's cracking GPT 4.5 on tasks like science. So they're clearly, putting themselves out there as a frontier model provider and doing that in the open, I think is only going to continue to put more pressure on these closed labs to release some of their work out in the open as well and more broadly help the community. So that's really interesting. I think there is a lot to be said about the mixture of experts architecture that's going on. Where we see, obviously DeepSeek made this famous when they first released back in December or so, with not first release, but released a big update to their family. It's an architecture that's been used more broadly even before that, but I'm really hopeful that this release will help get broader community support behind mixture of expert architecture, because there's just tons of really interesting things about it. Very training efficient, inference efficient, particularly if run at a low batch size. So you only have to use the experts that you need to call at inference time, which, if you're just running, one or two tasks can be run really efficiently. You start to lose a little bit of that if you have to run these at much larger batch sizes because you have to load all your experts into memory. So most people don't quite realize that about mixture of experts. But either way, really excited to see just another Power Horse model get released. In this case, two Power Horse models get released out into the open.
Yeah, for sure. And if you can go into that a little bit more for some of our listeners, I mean, it's namesake of the show, so I have to kind of fight for it. But it's like, has mixture of experts been a little bit uncool as of late? Like, I guess, is this kind of, it sounds like what you're implying is sort of like these models might like make it like a focus of the community again in a way that it hasn't in the past. And I'm kind of curious about how that's developed.
Well, I mean, even just with the Z system, right, we're talking about the focus on inference efficiency, running things quickly at inference time. And a lot of what requires that or what enables that is the community building open source software and platforms to be able to host and run these models as quickly and fast as possible. And just because the most popular open source models today, including prior generations of Llama, have been dense architecture models, a lot of the existing support for hosting and running these models, running them locally, hosting them and running them yourselves on platforms like VLM are, you know, predominantly based on some of those more popular dense architectures. So there is going to need to be kind of a groundswell movement of the community continuing to build out support. I think we've seen a lot of that already with the release of Llama 4. And I'm just excited to get more open source developers interested in mixture of experts as an architecture as a whole and continue to build out toolings and, you know, ways that we can work with these models more broadly.
Shobhit, maybe I'll bring you in here a little bit. You know, I think that there's often a way this discussion goes, which I think is like less interesting, where it's basically like, okay, Meta did this release. Now, like, who's ahead, you know, in this race? But like, I think that's often like the wrong way to think about it, particularly as the space gets more and more complex. Like, yeah. How should we read into this sort of launch about what Meta's strategy is and how it's trying to kind of like fill a niche in the market, right? Because I think rather than thinking about like, oh, DeepSeek is ahead or Meta's ahead, yeah. I think we should just kind of ask the question of just like, how are the strategies sort of evolving? And curious if you have some thoughts, like what you read into this launch, basically.
So let's just start by acknowledging what a consequential impact Llama has had on the industry. The Llama models have been, as of like 18th of March, they've been downloaded a billion times. Sure. Let's just let that sink in. A billion
That's a
times you've downloaded a model and made different versions of it, adapted it, and things of that nature, right? So a lot of enterprises that we work with, we are very focused on how do I adapt a model to our enterprise-specific domain, our data, and the way we want the model to behave, right? That adaptation comes only when you're really, really open. There are certain frontier models that can be adapted fine-tuning, but then you're sending your proprietary data to the cloud. That's a no-go. So usually open models, open weight models are fine in that space where you can go and tune them to that. So our own Granite models, there's some models from Mistral and DeepSeek and others are also open weights and open models. But it takes quite a bit to create a good mechanism to assess the quality of an output. So for a lot of our clients, we have to go and build end-to-end LLM benchmarking mechanisms. How do you evaluate the output on your specific documents? So the benchmark results that are public, those are a good starting point to get you a directional vibe check and say, yeah, it's worth looking at because Llama 4 did X better. But none of my clients jump up and down saying that, oh my God, this is like 0.2 points higher than the other one, right? People have other criteria that we use to judge which LLM we should be leveraging. It starts by IP, who can own the IP on that model. It starts by where the data gravity, AI model follows the data gravity. It's actually commitments that you've made to specific cloud vendors, right? There is things around, can I adapt this to my own environment? And then return on investment, the overall ROI of running these models. So you'll see a trend towards every 6 months, the next size smaller model gets smart enough to outcompete the previous one from 6 months back. So you're seeing this constant trend where we're getting really good power, like the performance to the cost ratio, right? I think that's the sweet spot. And Llama has done a really good job. I would anticipate that we'll continue this trajectory of a billion downloads and we'll have different adapted versions of Llama available for our enterprises. That's the right frame to look at it versus, oh my God, this just crushed the numbers on this particular task. Then there is there are other models that will constantly innovate with new methodologies. I think DeepSeek did a phenomenal job with some of the paperwork. Our Granite models, we have some really nice tricks up our sleeves in our own models and to give back to the community too. So I'm just super pumped about the community coming together, open source, getting to a point we can adapt it to the enterprise and very, very focused on intelligence divided by the price and the wattage and that kind of a metric.
Hillary, maybe I'll bring you in, just to talk a little bit about this behemoth model. I know it wasn't released, but it is like shockingly large. and it's cool on one level. You're like, wow, okay, it's like really, it's really big. I'm kind of curious though, like from your point of view, you know, the degree to which like these are actually kind of like practical models that a lot of people will use in the wild, because it sort of feels like the kind of infra you need to pull off, like really actually serving and using a model of the scale. Like there's part of me is like, is this just kind of a more of a marketing thing than it is actually like a practical reality? But I'm curious about your take on this is like, is there room for open source on the like mega, mega, mega scale model? Just because it kind of almost like limits like the set of people who would actually practically end up using it.
Yeah, I guess I have a lot of similar thoughts to what Shobhit just shared. A couple of things, right? I mean, within IBM infrastructure, we're also handling creating the cloud infrastructure for watsonx and deployment of all these inference services and stuff like that. So the other part of my brain is looking at how do we bring, you know, more and more powerful accelerators of all kinds into that cloud environment to do whatever it is that watsonx needs to do, right? So if our customers are going to need those really big models, I'm not going to be the one that says, no, we won't provide the infrastructure for it, right? So we're advancing with NVIDIA and Intel and AMD and putting, you know, new and more GPUs out there to enable people to play around with models as large as they feel like are going to be useful. I think on the practical side, though, we see a lot of experimentation or attempts to use these things maybe from a teaching perspective. But then when it comes to scaling out deployments, almost all of our customers then start to engage with us on how can I customize smaller things, right? So I feel like you sort of have to know where things are at on the large side and what it might do for you. You may use that to inform yourself on, you know, what the solution might look like, or maybe create, you know, additional tuning data or something like that, you know, to get that characteristic that you need out of something that's then going to be affordable to scale. So I continue, like Shobhit, to see most of our customers saying, hey, you know, work largely in kind of the B2B space is IBM. We're working with other large enterprises who have millions to hundreds of millions of clients. And when you're wanting to engage with all of them and run at business scale of billions and hundreds of millions of things and people, the affordability very quickly kind of kicks in and people, you know, start looking at customization of smaller things for real scale out of deployments.
Well, and if I can make a prediction based off of what Hillary, you just said, and kind of speaking to Shobhit, what you mentioned about, you know, small LLMs are increasingly being able to do more things. You know, my prediction is that most of the models for Llama 4 that were released, they're very, even the smallest one is quite big, you know, 100 billion parameters. I think they're going to be used most by the community to fine tune some of the older, smaller Llama 3 models. So if we look at what can run on a laptop, what you can easily train and customize, you're really talking, you know, like 1 to 10 billion parameters in size, more, and, you know, maybe a dense architecture because there's a lot of tuning support for that kind of model already created. So I think that some of the most immediate uses of these biggest models are going to be to continue on that trend of how do we get those smaller models even more performant by using those bigger models to be able to teach, to be able to generate data, to be able to help augment existing enterprise data and create more of it, and then bring that and pack that down into smaller models like the older generations of Llama, our generation of Granite, all playing at that, you know, single digit billion parameter size frame.
I totally agree, Kate. And I think one other, you know, little factoid, I'm sure you guys have talked about this before, but it's estimated that only about 1% of enterprise data or 1% of the things an enterprise needs a model to use are contained in publicly available models, right? So as you think about that, it has to be that an enterprise is going to be customizing something. And then the question is, what is that something? And is that something affordable enough then to scale?
Yeah, and the size, and both the size of the model, but also the context window size, right? 10 million parameters, the context window, what a world we live in, right? I can just dump a bunch of data to it and talk against it. But it takes a lot to host these models. So a lot of different vendors who are offering inference infrastructure, the same exact model, it is complex to host this and get it right. Each vendor is offering different kinds of context windows because not everybody can pull off a 10 million infrastructure the way you fine tune it, so on and so forth, right? Even companies that do third-party analysis, artificial analysis and stuff like that, it took them a few turns to get the models to be provided the inference infrastructure just right to be able to match what Llama had claimed to be the the results in their papers and stuff like that. So it takes a few rounds to get this done. And I believe that this just speaks to the complexity of some of these larger models on how much difference you see from the same prompt being sent to three different or seven different vendors who are hosting this model have slightly different responses. And you see quite a bit of a difference between the two. So I think we'll get to a point where derivatives of Llama 4, the data that's created, synthetic data out of Llama 4, and some of the new techniques that they released will make their ways into smaller models. And those are the ones that will scale across different companies. But I'm generally very, very excited of these big releases that model companies are doing. They're still sticking to their open weight models. There's still the restrictions that come with the Meta license that's not quite Apache and MIT. But overall, our clients have loved the fact that we can now outcompete each other in the AI space, and all clients win when you have great AI labs working on this together.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic, which is Google Cloud Next. Shobhit, you're actually dialing in straight from Vegas, so I'll kick it over to you. You've been there all week. What are the big things that we should know about coming out of this this show?
It's lovely to be with developers and just people who are hacking through and clients who are actually using it. 500 customer logos on screen. Like, that's where Google Cloud is today. Like, that's such a great testament to where they were 2-3 years back. And they've done quite a bit to make sure that they are serving the enterprises and they have more and more data, cloud is growing, profitable, things of that nature. When you start to look at how they're bringing AI across the entire platform, how they are exposing some of their internal strengths. So as a great example, they have amazing TPUs to train their own models for their own use cases, right? YouTube, Search, Gemini, across mobile apps and whatnot, right? So they're bringing that TPU out to enterprises and they're constantly innovating on that. So their latest release, Ironwood, amazing progress that they've made on their own chips. Then there's a lot of stuff that Google does internally to support their billions of users. So things like their own wide area network of fiber. It's millions of miles of fiber that they've now exposed to enterprise users and stuff. So they're seeming to make a very concerted effort in making sure that their secret sauce is now available to the end enterprises to use as well. Overall, they spent a lot of time on media creation. Versus use cases like coding or data and things of that nature. The media creation, clearly, they're the only cloud that can do this end-to-end across all these different modalities, creating content. I was privileged to be part of the Sphere experience on day zero, where they showed us the Wizard of Oz and what they're doing to do this on such a mega scale. Right? It's a great experience to see AI leveraging the best techniques to go create such a immersive experience on this big Sphere scope. So a lot in the media space, but not a lot of our enterprise clients jump up and down on the media topic. There's marketing, great. There's some video creation. But the bigger focus on our enterprises are, what do I do with the call center? What do I do in my code development processes? My data is messy and things of that nature. So they made quite a bit of announcements in the space. They have been, for the last few weeks, announcing newer and newer models. It's just amazing to see how 10 days before your annual event, you're releasing your Gemini 2.5, right? It's just great. People hold on to these big announcements, but in this AI race, you can't wait for 10 days. You need to get Gemini 2.5 out before Llama 4 comes in. So it's good to see that progress is going really fast. The performance per intelligence per dollar, Gemini Flash has been doing really, really well. They continue to do that. A lot of talk about their Gemini 2.5 Pro model across the board on the benchmarks and on all the different things that matter, including the last exam for humanity, is absolutely number one. So huge focus on that. Just shifting a little bit more towards the agents space. We had MCP from Anthropic, which allows an LLM to, in a structured way with a standard protocol, access backend systems and stuff like that. To complement that, Google has created its own agent-to-agent protocol, which allows one agent to talk to the other agent, not as a tool, but as an equal citizen, like equal level citizen.
So
both of them can peer and they can talk to each other and say, hey, I found this error. What do you want me to do this? Or maybe go talk to a human if needed. And this is asynchronous. It takes a while. It can take long working tasks and they can talk to them back and forth. I'm generally very pumped when we get to a point where people start
collecting around specific standards. Google had a lot of different partners, 50 plus, already working on agent to agent. Within IBM Consulting, we obviously have a really good agentic workflow. We have our own IBM Consulting Advantage. We already have MCP integrated into it. Now we are working on agent to agent within that space as well. So we're getting really, really excited about making sure that this is very open ecosystem and you're working sideways. Those were my highlights from the Google event. Just very pumped about the clients talking about the specifics of how they did it. It's not just a 30-second video, but a whole half an hour session. Let's deep dive. Here are the challenges. Here's our journey of which models we use and so on and so forth. So it's very good to work with the product teams and the customers in these events.
That's great. Yeah. So I guess, Hillary, an avalanche of announcements here from a number of different directions. I'm curious, I think, as you kind of like look at Google Cloud and what they're announcing, trends, thoughts, hot takes from this year's Google Cloud Next.
Yeah, one of the things that caught my eye that Shobhit didn't have on his list, so I can grab onto it and mention
it. missed one, Shobhit.
Yeah. So they also talked about AI on-premises and offering those capabilities. And I think that's also exciting to see in the sense of, again, it affirms kind of what we've been thinking here, that clients do need to be able to run AI in an air-gapped environment. We keep saying that AI is a platform conversation and that AI and hybrid cloud are two sides of the same coin. And really, that's a statement going back to everything we were talking at the beginning, that there is data in really important places and that data needs to be secured. Sometimes it needs to adhere to sovereignty concerns and other things like that. And so bringing AI to the data and the fact that, you know, one of their announcements this week affirmed that is something that they also see as important, I think is just a really good affirmation of what we're also seeing in the enterprise space, that got to bring the AI to the data. AI is a decision about how flexibly you can deploy AI in all those locations that you have data and customers. It's not just a decision about only which model and only which location it runs in.
Any final takes, Kate? I don't know if you had any thoughts from this year's Google Cloud Next on any and all of this. I mean, it's just like remarkable every time like Shobhit comes to a show and is like, here's what's happening. And it just feels like it's like this like voluminous list that I have trouble parsing. But
I know, I need a Shobhit to decompose all of these main tech conferences going on. It's great. No, I mean, obviously from my perspective, I'm most interested in things like the Gemini 2.5 Pro release, which has been really impressive, honestly, getting great vibe checks from that model. Really exciting to see them really kind of take center stage and have a strong release there. So, more great models out there only improves what the field can accomplish. So from that perspective, really excited to see them push the boundaries.
Yeah, I think just one last parting thought. I think Google is really flexing its B2C learnings, right? The fact that they can train their models from so much content. And again, I'm not getting into where the content is coming from and like and indemnification, stuff like that. I'm just purely commenting on the fact that they can train on so much more real world information from B2C space, right? There's nobody else who has access to so much data B2C, right? So the video generation, for example, the videos that they are creating are very, very cinematic, and it seems like they have really gone out and looked at all of the YouTube videos from really good creators and stuff like that. So the quality is really good, and it's translating into voice experience. And this is becoming more and more critical for clients to vendors to get voice right. And I think they have an unfair advantage in the space where they can go and provide some very nice audio experiences as you're thinking through. So one small example was, if I have some Google Docs and stuff like that, I can ask an agent to say, create a particular workflow, do some research, and then create a very long research paper. So now it's created a 3-page paper on a particular topic on why your margins are dropping though your revenues are going up, and it'll do competitive analysis and all this stuff, create a 3-page paper. I can click a button and create an audio podcast out of it, right? And this like corporate enterprise stuff that's so difficult to consume, and now you're plugging in a really nice audio layer on top of it, and I can listen to it on my drive to work, right? I think the fact they have an unfair advantage on the audio and the experience side, that starts to give them some advantages on the enterprise side as well. That's some of the other peers of theirs don't have.
With these podcasts going up on YouTube, maybe, Kate, you'll get the digital twin of Showbit that you've been wishing for.
Exactly. As long as you get some royalties from it. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. There's ad dollars there. So, I think the future of like educational entertainment here is really funny and interesting to think about is like, convert all my emails of the day into a Netflix series. I can just watch when I get home. You know, I think we will start to enter this like very strange world.
But here's the kicker, man. I'll absolutely close on this. I want to live in a world where I can insert myself, Showbit, inside of a movie scene that I'm seeing. Right? If Iron Man comes to a bar and orders a drink, I want to be the bartender, right? If you have all the celebrities on screen, I want to be part of that. I could be the driver of, like, I want to immerse myself as part of the video. And this was not possible till today, right? So if you look at how far we have come with the video creation, I think we're at a point where we'll have super personalized movies where they'll be cracking jokes that I do on my daily basis too.
So I'm going to move us on to our final topic of the day. I'd be remiss to mention this, even though we just have a few minutes on the episode today. I really encourage you, if you're listening to the show, to check out this super interesting report that came out of Pew Research. Essentially, it's a survey of American perceptions around AI and how people use AI in their everyday lives. And I think we only have enough time to kind of do a few kind of hot takes here. But I think one sort of really interesting takeaway from this report was the degree to which sort of experts in AI have views about AI that are really, really divergent from, you know, people who are just kind of like using or experiencing AI in their like everyday lives, or even just having heard about it and never used the technology at all. And I think maybe, Kate, I'll kick it to you. I think like one of the really interesting results was, you know, all these kind of data points about, you know, experts saying that jobs won't be impacted by AI, but people really feeling like jobs will be impacted by AI. Experts generally being a lot more positive on the technology than the general public is. Do you feel like this kind of impacts the kind of prospects for AI going forwards? Just kind of curious about your quick take in the minutes that we have.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting things from the Pew report. Definitely not enough to get fully into right now, but I think it speaks to the optimism of the researchers involved, which is great because we need people optimistic about the impact of technology and science on the world to be the ones inventing and trying to push it forward. But I also think it speaks a bit what I saw to some of the representation in technology and that we still have work to do to get better representation to more reflect the world building this technology. So if you also look at, they broke down, you know, men versus women's perception of technology and how it will impact. It's similarly men matched AI experts, and it will be no surprise to anyone that most of the AI experts in the research field is still predominantly, you know, the work is being done by men. So I think there's also, you know, it reflects just some of the needed diversity and different opinions and broader perspectives that we still have room to grow and bring into AI research as a discipline as a whole.
I think it's a great note to end on. And I think hopefully it was a good sell for you all to go check out the report. I think there's a lot of data there, and I think it's worth really parsing through. And I agree with you. I think it really points out sort of the need for greater efforts on diversity in the space. Well, as per usual, I say this every episode now. I feel it's like almost a tradition, like saying agent in every single episode, but we have had more things to cover than we have had time to cover today. But Showbit, Kate, Hillary, thanks for ably guiding us through for our 50th episode. And thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.